Welcome. Good evening. This is Perry Hoffman.
Okay.
It's a call for our NEABPD call-in series. We're delighted to have all of you on, and tonight especially interesting is Dr. Eunice Chen talking about eating disorders. So I'm going to turn the call over to Dr. Chen. I do want to thank you so much for joining us. Also want to thank the Gunderson residents, who is helping to support these call-ins, and any and all of you who send in donations. We're so appreciative. It allows us to offer these services for free. So we hope all of you who are on the call will think to make a donation. And just also to say that next week we have Charlie Swenson, who will be doing DDT Part 2, and also share with us an up and new venture that he's going to be joining NEABPD with, so we're very excited. So, Dr. Chen, I turn the microphone or the phone over to you, and again say thank you so much for joining us and taking your time to do this.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Perry. I really appreciate the privilege of being able to talk to everybody about eating and weight disorders. And Perry asked me to briefly introduce myself. I'm at the University of Chicago. Currently, I run the Adult Eating and Weight Disorders program there. I primarily work on treatment studies, usually using dialectic behavior therapy, cognitive behavior therapy, or family-based treatments. And previously, I worked as a postdoc with Marsha Linehan, who, of course, developed DBT. And I also worked at Yale at the Eating and Weight Disorders program there. But as you can hear from my accent, I'm originally from Australia. And, you know, I'm hoping, like, this is a very general talk about eating disorders. So I am hopeful that please ask lots of questions. I think I'll finish, I said to Perry, in about 45 minutes. So I would love to hear your questions. I know I haven't talked huge amounts about treatment, but we can definitely talk more about that if that's of interest to folk. Okay.
Eunice, I'm just going to press the mute button because I'm not sure that everybody's on mute, so just bear with me. It'll be two beats. Okay, thanks.
Okay. Okie dokes. So you know, whenever I talk about eating disorders, I always talk to folk about weight generally in our culture, because I do think that, you know, eating disorders are, you know, you've got to take it in the context of understanding how we view weight in our culture and also what we know about weight as far as biology. Because I think in our culture, I mean, it's probably clear to everybody here, there's a real discrepancy between, you know, what our biology dictates, okay, that we can be in terms of weight, and also what the culture, our culture, thinks it ought to be, okay? And so, you know, it might be about 50% of the variability in your weight that's actually associated with the genes that you inherit from your parents. And, of course, you can't choose who your parents are. So there's, I think, an important aspect of weight that's about biology. And at the same time, I think we've got a culture where it can be a series of harmful messages that I think not just women but also men are given that make it tricky to try to deal with this fact that our bodies are built to be a certain way but that our culture would suggest that they should be otherwise. And so I think...
I'm sorry to interrupt. I just got an email from someone that some people are having trouble hearing you. Can you talk just a little louder?
Oh, absolutely. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah? Okay. Okay, so hopefully folk can hear me, and if not, please tell Perry. And okay, so we're just talking a little bit about the discrepancy between biology and culture and the fact that, you know, our biology dictates our bodies to be a certain way, and everyone is you-sized, okay, but that we are in a culture of often harmful messages. And so I think classic messages are things like you can never be too thin enough. This is for women, or buff enough if you're a bloke. I think other sort of messages in our culture are things like your weight is a moral issue. So there are studies that show that, you know, if people are forced to think what the associations are with different weights, they would argue, or they would almost unconsciously say that being overweight, being associated with being lazy, being underweight, however, is associated with being hardworking, when we know that weight is not about a moral issue. The other thing, of course, is that we're in a culture where there's a lot of messages about eating more. And so it's not just eating more, it's that there's a lot of food that's convenient and cheap, that's widely available, but that is also perhaps not nutritionally the most balanced of foods. So unfortunately, we're in that as well. And all these kind of messages, I think, make it very confusing for everybody, you know, as to, well, what weight should I be and what's healthy and what's not healthy? Okay. My next slide, if you've got your slides in front of you, is actually of, I guess, you know, when you grow up, possibly our favorite couple, okay, Ken and Barbie. And the reason why I put that there is because I think they're a good example of how, you know, our biology might dictate one thing, okay, but, you know, our culture from the earliest of days while growing up dictates to us another thing. So if you look on the next slide, what you'll see is that should you really want to be Ken or Barbie? If you wanted to be Ken and Barbie, actually, you'd have to grow a lot taller. So this is the average person would have to grow a lot taller. You'd either have to have more inches around the waist if you wanted to be Ken, or to lose them if you wanted to be Barbie. And also, in the case of both Ken and Barbie, your chest would have to expand significantly. And in fact, there's some data that suggests that should you want to be, say, Barbie, you'd actually fall over because your chest would be too large to be able to support your frame. So, you know, there are some issues about, you know, the kind of messages that are promoted in our culture from early on that I think really make it difficult, not just for clients who suffer eating disorders, but for all of us in trying to think about and understand, you know, what weight should I be given all these messages and also given my biology. So I think the next slide, if you've got it in front of you, is taken from, I think it's the New York Times, it's the New Yorker, sorry. And where really it's saying to, I think, all of us, you know, in the world where we are surrounded by messages of ideals of being Barbie, you know, what is normal? You know, what's a normal weight? How do you eat normally? How do you exercise normally? That's kind of a tricky thing to negotiate. And that's something that folk with eating disorders, as well as the rest of us, have to also try to negotiate. I think obviously, though, in the case of folk with an eating disorder, these kind of negotiations are probably more extreme struggles, okay? And what I thought I'd do is just sort of briefly introduce the different sorts of eating disorders to allow us to discuss these things. So you guys have probably been already exposed by other folk to the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. We're on the fourth edition, but we're going to go to the fifth. And you know, we're going to talk about three different disorders. We're going to talk about anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, and eating disorders not otherwise specified, of which there's a particular research diagnosis called binge eating disorder that we will also briefly talk about. So just as a way of introduction, you know, anorexia nervosa is probably the least frequently occurring of the eating disorders, but it is probably the most lethal. Like if you look at the rates of mortality with anorexia, what I think shocks still, you know, whenever I give these talks, I always am still shocked by the fact that the mortality rate is probably the highest for any psychological or psychiatric condition. And that's despite, though, it's not as frequently occurring, perhaps, as other disorders. The other things are about anorexia nervosa is we don't have many good treatments for this disorder. So although there's a strong treatment, I think, in the view of the evidence for children and adolescents utilizing family-based treatment, For adults, there have been many studies done that have often been small, which means that they're not powered enough for us to be able to draw conclusions from, but that don't really show any sort of strong forerunner as a form of treatment. The studies, I think the largest study that is out there had a very large dropout rate. So that is classic, unfortunately, for the studies for treatment for anorexia. And it means that it's something that a lot of researchers around the country and around the world are really trying very hard and have been doing so for a long time to work out how to better treat. So anyway, so anorexia, just to give it a little bit of background, you know, you probably know that it means that people are maintaining a very low body weight, and, you know, different sort of classification systems define this differently. So in the case of the International Classification of Diseases, which often you might find the medical community uses, folk use something called the Body Mass Index, which we'll talk a little bit about later, but it's a form of calculation that would suggest that if you have a body mass index of less than 17.5, you might meet this criteria for anorexia nervosa. Now, in the case of the DSM-4, so the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, which is probably more used by the psychological psychiatric community, it's actually less than 85% of that expected for your age and for your height. It's also associated with, you know, being very fearful about gaining weight or becoming fat. And so, for instance, if we ask clients, as we often do in a standardized interview called the Eating Disorders Examination, look, if you gained 1 pound, how would you feel? Often this would result in, you know, extreme distress, much more than you might see with other, you know, most folk, okay? And, you know, just typically, most of us are going to definitely gain 2 pounds at least each month if you're a woman, okay? And this, however, can really fluctuate. So I've seen people who can gain up to 10 pounds in the course of a month and really cycle like that. So gaining weight is quite a normal process throughout the course of the month. And so, you know, a sort of extreme fear of weight gain of only 1 pound is pretty extreme. Okay, other things that one might notice in the case of anorexia is that people have a disturbance in the way in which they view their bodies. Now, it is interesting because many of the clients that I work with are able to see that other people are underweight, but they find it hard to perceive it in themselves. And there's some, you know, very interesting neurobiological data that suggests that it might be actually parts of the brain that are associated with in what we call interoceptive perception. So it's sort of having the sense of one's body or experiencing it, that is actually disturbed, even in people who have recovered physically from the symptoms of anorexia nervosa. So, you know, I think the more that people have been doing and researching anorexia is that we're starting to realize that there's some very important neurobiological differences that might be driving this disorder. I think what's also important just to note about this is that often, you know, weight and shape is very focused upon as a way in which one evaluates one's self-worth. But I think there's something even more important than that, and that is this last component of you know, this particular symptom, and that is denial of the seriousness of the current body weight. And this is something we don't see in many other psychological problems. Like if you think about it, you know, if someone says I'm depressed or anxious, it's not usually that people are denying the fact that they're feeling this way. Okay, there might be certain circumstances where people do, but in the case of anorexia nervosa, you can imagine what is really tricky to try to help people, like be it family members, or friends, but also as a treatment provider, what is really tricky is the fact that often people don't see that they have a problem and secondly, don't see how serious it is. Okay, and that might lead to why, you know, many of the treatments that I think are being, you know, that show helpfulness for clients are ones that, you know, get around this particular problem. So if children and adolescents are targeted in a family-based treatment, for instance, you know, the children or adolescent may deny having the symptoms, but often the parents don't. And, you know, children and adolescents can therefore be refed in that sort of situation. Okay, so other components about anorexia, there's an amenorrhea criteria, so we're on to the next slide, and there are different sorts of subtypes of anorexia, restricting subtype and a binge-purge subtype. Now, notably, I think, importantly, with the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, the fifth edition, we will probably drop the amenorrhea criteria, and I think there is a move as well to relax the body mass index or the weight criteria, because what we realize as often clinicians and professionals is that, you know, it's much better to try to help someone early in the process of anorexia, like maybe their BMI is 18, but it's getting towards a body mass index of 17.5. So it's better to help people earlier rather than later, given how serious this disease is. So I said I promised that I'd talk to you a little bit about body mass indices so that you'd understand how to calculate it. It is basically mass in pounds divided by height in inches squared, and that's all multiplied by the magic number of 703. Now, it's all a bit, like, tricky, like, I think more complicated because originally the way it was calculated was in kilos and meters squared. But I do want to just highlight some things. You know, you can see different health organizations will actually try to cut up the body mass indices in different ways. And I think what I usually say to folk is that, you know, to me as a health practitioner, having a body mass index around 17.5 or below is very concerning because I'm realizing a person is very low weight and desperately needs treatment. However, I also take into account that, you know, the body mass index, it's a calculation, and it's one that is, you know, it provides a general rule of thumb, but it is not like a, okay, be all and end all, because you can see it doesn't include in it a calculation or an attempt to work out, okay, given someone's genetics, where do they sit in all this? So when you look at, for instance, the World Health Organization criteria, you know, the body mass index, especially for like being overweight and obese, it's interesting because over the decades, this has definitely changed because that's very culturally shaped. But you'll also see the CDC, so the Centers of Disease Control, divides up those categories differently. But I usually would say to people, you know, when it's on the extremes, like, you know, around 17.5, then I start getting worried as somebody who treats people with eating disorders and also with weight problems. Okay, so medical problems associated with anorexia, okay. You know, you can see that on the next slide that these are very serious, so menstrual reproductive complications, osteopenia or osteoporosis, so having decreased bone mass. So this can put, you know, young women who have anorexia at, you know, extreme risk. And in actual fact, if you look at their bone density scans, you can see that they have bone density scans of a much older person often. Other things are, you know, people will complain of feeling bloated, constipation, pain in the stomach, okay. Often this might happen when someone's also in the process of being refed, okay, always in trying to get their weight back to a healthier range. But I think the thing that often, sadly enough, is what causes a lot of people's death with anorexia is cardiovascular problems. And you'll see that things like cardiac failure is about half of the people that die from anorexia will die from cardiovascular problems. Interestingly enough, the other half will die from suicide. So, you know, that, I mean, just in passing to note. The other things are, you know, there are a lot of kind of other complications, like renal and metabolic complications that mean that people feel very sensitive to cold and to heat. So you'll see folk, you know, wearing sweaters even if it's summer, you know, the height of summer. And then you can see all other sorts of problems like hematological, dermatological, and also neurological kind of difficulties. I'll just highlight with the dermatological, you know, my clients find very upsetting with, you know, extreme weight loss, you'll start to lose your hair on your head, or it might become very brittle. The other thing is that you might grow what we call lanugo hair, which is this very fine hair on the body. The other thing is there are neurological things that people experience, often as like fatigue and dizziness. And this can make it, of course, very difficult in the context of, say, treatment to be able to concentrate in the context of school. So often clients will report, although they're doing very well at school, they might be spending a lot of hours trying to concentrate on their work. Okay. Just trying to think. Okay, we'll move on and just talk briefly about bulimia. So bulimia nervosa is another eating disorder. It's different from anorexia nervosa, which is more typified by extreme weight loss, in that bulimia nervosa is characterized by large episodes of binge eating, which are followed then by compensation. Now, when we talk about binge eating, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual defines this in a certain way. So it's eating a lot of food in a discrete period of time, usually about 2 hours, but that's actually larger than most people would eat during a similar period of time or under a similar circumstance. And importantly, the other component of the binge is that there's a sense of loss of control. So there's a feeling that one can't stop once you start, for instance. So I think just to, the reason why I point this out is because the community studies that show that a lot of us overeat, okay, but it might not necessarily be of this nature where we experience like a loss of control, nor is it that we eat more than actually a person would typically eat in, say, a circumstance. Okay, the other thing is bulimia is typified, as I said, by, you know, after the binge, some sort of compensation. And the most frequently occurring one is self-induced vomiting, but it may also involve other things such as abusing laxatives, diuretics, enemas or other medications like diet pills, or fasting, or excessive exercise. So, which you can also imagine is kind of tricky to try to work out what's extreme, you know, especially sometimes you might, you know, have somebody who's an athlete and then it's like, well, what's extreme? So those kind of things often we'll ask questions about to what degree is it about weight and shape concerns. We'll ask, you know, have other people noticed it, because often coaches might have noticed it. We also, or people at the gym who have said, oh, you know, you're on the machines for too long. The other thing is that for the clients that I've worked with bulimia, these can be as extreme as, you know, I've had clients who've, you know, continue jogging despite having a fractured leg. So very extreme kind of exercise behavior despite injury. Okay, the other thing is that the DSM just defines that this sort of behavior happens twice a week for the last 3 months. And that, like anorexia, there is this kind of, you know, one's self-worth and one's self-esteem is very based on weight and shape. The other thing is, the thing about bulimia is that it doesn't occur, though, in the context of anorexia. So it doesn't occur in people who, it's not, you know, basically it's not seen as, it's seen, sorry, as anorexia nervosa if you, say, binge and vomit but are at a low weight. So that diagnosis trumps the bulimia nervosa diagnosis. And then as with anorexia, there are two different types, a purging type and also a non-purging type. So it's subtypes, but they're kind of differently defined, as you can see here. Now, with bulimia, there are also some serious medical problems. I think the main ones that are important are, you know, fluid and electrolyte damage that comes from frequent purging. So this might be like hyperkalemia. And, you know, they basically, this kind of secondary problem is important because it has then effects on one's cardiovascular functioning. And so a lot of people who suffer from medical instability associated with bulimia have heart problems because of electrolyte damage. There are also people who report gastrointestinal complaints, you know, feeling like constipated, sometimes irritable bowel kind of symptoms. You know, bulimia is associated with often swollen glands. You know, they're sort of cheek glands that are swollen because of the vomiting. And then I guess the other things just to point out is that often people will suffer from headaches and, you know, difficulties with concentration and problem solving as well because of all the kind of behaviors, the binging and the purging. Okay, on the next page, you know, the other things are one of the problems that are consistent, even if you get better from bulimia nervosa, is dental decay that might occur from vomiting. As an aside, dentists who I've, you know, talked to and worked with over time, they can actually tell when someone is vomiting frequently because of the kind of marks that it makes on the teeth. Now, the mortality rate for bulimia is lower than, say, with anorexia. But, you know, it's still a serious problem because of the serious sort of medical instabilities that can result from the behavior. Both anorexia and bulimia, though, have very similar psychological problems that you'll see as well. So for both of these problems, there's often preoccupation with food and weight and shape, so thinking a lot about this, and that's what often disrupts people's concentration. There's often people report, you know, mood swings, depression. So in the case of, say, bulimia, it might be mood swings because, you know, eating a lot of food might actually feel pretty good, but then trying immediately to find a bathroom or, you know, dealing with the consequences of binging can lead to, you know, a downward mood swing. People often report, you know, a lot of preoccupation and anxiety about food and food situations. So people might find that it's easier to avoid going out, but as a result, over time, they end up losing friends. So social withdrawal can result. Often low self-esteem goes along with these problems. Obsessiveness, maybe around eating or dressing. Perfectionism, and that's something that one might see in either of these problems. With both of these problems, one would also probably see poor sleep. And sometimes odd eating patterns, I think more so in anorexia than in bulimia from my clinical experience. So that's like unusual combinations of food, which might not taste very good. Okay, the other things are, what are the kind of problems associated, like, of a severe enough level for them to be, you know, diagnosable that go along with anorexia and bulimia? Probably the most frequently occurring one is major depression. Other ones are anxiety disorders, and certain sort of anxiety problems might be more associated, or we'll see them more frequently with these disorders. A good example being obsessive compulsive disorder, particularly with anorexia nervosa. Drug and alcohol problems might also go hand in hand with these, with anorexia and bulimia. Maybe more so, though, bulimia. And then certain personality disorders, such as borderline personality disorder in the case of bulimia nervosa, and obsessive compulsive personality disorder in the case of anorexia nervosa. There's also some suggestion that in the case of anorexia, there may be differences between the individuals who are purely restricting, so the people that purely diet or fast, versus people who purge. So there's some suggestion that certain sorts of co-occurring problems are particularly associated with people who purge, and that's more things like drug and alcohol and borderline personality disorder. Okay, I've talked a little bit, or some of this I haven't pointed out, but I do think it's important, you know, in anorexia nervosa and bulimia nervosa, about 90 to 95% of cases are women, but, you know, it might be higher, though, for bulimia. In anorexia, though, I mean, as I said to you guys earlier, its prevalence is pretty low, 0.9%. Bulimia is more frequently occurring, about 1 to 2%. But I also would like to point out, you know, it depends on, you know, what's the sample that you're looking at. So if you're looking at a college-age sample, you might see that these rates are actually much higher. okay, I've talked to you guys about, you know, anorexia being a very serious disorder. So those are some points about that, like it's the third most common chronic condition in adolescent girls and women, preceded only by obesity and asthma. It's also got the highest mortality rate for any psychiatric illness. And then, you know, in the case of bulimia, though, what is interesting about that epidemiologically is just that there seems to be an increase in this particular disorder over time in successive cohorts. And this is something that's been found not just in American studies, but also in studies like done in New Zealand, for instance. Okay, the next slide's about the course and the outcome of anorexia. So again, anorexia particularly, though, starts in adolescence, and it peaks around the age of 18. You know, in terms of mortality rate, like if you look at older, longer-term studies, so Steinhausen published this paper that looked at, you know, 20-year studies that suggested that one in five people with anorexia nervosa would die. So that was, these were older studies though, so hopefully treatment has improved. You can see a more recent figure suggests that 4-year follow-up studies suggest that, you know, the mortality rate is lower than that, so it's 5%, but you can still see that like 25% are still ill, and 15% actually have recovered body weight, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're fully well as far as, you know, the cognitions associated with anorexia. And so I think, you know, there's another, I've thrown in there just another paper that suggests that the mortality rate for anorexia is particularly serious, with it being 5 times of that of the same age, same sex population, as opposed to, say, even major depression, where it's only 1.4 times. Okay, the course and outcome of bulimia, though, this often happens later, though, in adolescence to early 20s, and there's a significant group of folk for whom it occurs after a period of having anorexia nervosa. But for the majority of people who have bulimia nervosa or develop it, it's actually occurred after a period of dieting or restriction in some way. The studies are now showing that, you know, there is a lot of what we call migration between problems, so between anorexia and bulimia, less so between bulimia and anorexia. And I think we're only starting to understand, say, the relationship between bulimia and binge eating disorder, which, of course, is still only a research diagnosis at this stage. The thing about bulimia is that it can have a waxing and waning course, so it can worsen during periods of stress. However, you can see that the outcome is, I think, a little bit more promising in some ways than anorexia. So about 50% of folk are fully recovered in some of these follow-up studies, with only 20% meeting full criteria for bulimia and 30% getting better but then having a relapse. And as I said earlier, the mortality rate is lower than that in anorexia. Okay, the case with bulimia nervosa, I want to put out there, is just that I think that there are treatments that can be very helpful for folk with bulimia. We know that antidepressants, things like fluoxetine, can be very helpful. We also know that given clinical trials, calm behavior therapy that's very focused on bulimia nervosa symptoms is a treatment manual that was originally developed by Chris Fairbairn in the UK, that has very strong outcomes. So about 50% of people are better after about, the treatment studies do range, but it's roughly about 20 sessions or so. There's also something called interpersonal psychotherapy. Folk might be aware of that because it's been used a lot with major depression. But an adaptation of that for bulimia nervosa also has strong effects, although the study suggests that it may not work as quickly as cognitive behavior therapy. And, you know, there have been a variety of newer treatments that are also being used for bulimia nervosa. But I think, you know, possibly the reason why, you know, the outcome's better to some degree is because there's some treatments out there that show pretty strong efficacy data. Okay, And we can talk more about treatment later if that's of interest to folk. Binge eating disorder, so as I said, this is a research diagnosis currently, and it's different from bulimia in the sense that it's mainly typified by these objective binges. So it's mainly typified by those loss of control binges where people eat larger than people would eat during a typical, during that particular circumstance or within that period of time. And then there isn't compensation, unlike bulimia nervosa. Now, in the terms of these binges, for the research diagnosis at least, researchers are asked to consider that these binge eating episodes are associated with these different psychological characteristics. For instance, eating much more rapidly than normal, eating until uncomfortably full, etc. The other things are, you know, there's evidently distress about this kind of binge eating, and the requirement is that they happen 2 days a week at least for the last 6 months. And evidently these don't occur in the course of bulimia nervosa or binge eating disorder. Now, binge eating disorder is, I mean, technically, you know, regarded as an eating disorder is not otherwise specified currently, but it will probably become its own diagnostic entity in the new Diagnostic Statistical Manual version 5. I think it's important to point out, though, that binge eating disorder is very interesting in the context of trying to understand weight. Not everybody with binge eating disorder is overweight or obese. There is, though, a subgroup that folk who are. And we're still trying to understand that a little because there's some suggestion in the literature that it might be that if you're younger, that, you know, you might not be struggling with your weight. But then we also know that over time, regular objective binge eating, as seen in binge eating disorder, may develop obesity in folk over time. So there's some ideas that possibly binge eating disorder might be one of the many ways in which people develop overweight over time. And, you know, I think some of the things, though, that we know currently are on the next slide for binge eating disorder. We know, like as I pointed out, lifetime binge eating disorder might be associated with high body mass indices. It's probably the most frequently occurring of eating disorders with, like, community figures of a 3.5% prevalence rate in women and 2% among men. So it's unusual amongst the eating disorders in that it affects a substantial number of men. And, you know, as many, I mean, people that are seen sometimes for weight loss at university clinics, about 5 to 10% of those clients might actually have binge eating disorder. I think the other thing to point out, of course, it's a new diagnosis and, you know, a lot of people have struggled with this and from the child studies, we're now starting to understand binge eating disorder and binge eating might actually start very early in life, you know, in childhood. But we, because this has been a new diagnosis, we're only seeing people in treatment when they're in their 40s. But then the onset for many of these folk was much earlier. I think I also wanted to point something out about obesity and weight. I think it is important to remember, though, obesity is a multifactorial medical condition, can be caused by a lot of different things. And I think it's important to just note that it's a chronic medical condition because I think sometimes people have assumed that it's a psychological disorder or a psychiatric disorder. Obesity, I think, you know, as I said earlier, the data doesn't bear up that it's caused by greed, laziness, or a lack of control, or in other words, moral things. And actually, the majority of our population is overweight or obese. I think a lot of this is due to what I talked about earlier, just that, you know, we have certain genetics, and then unfortunately, we're in the environment that basically, you know, wants us to be thinner, but also at the same time, you know, promotes all this convenience lifestyle improving things that mean that it supports being a higher weight. Okay, and then I think just other things to point out about obesity are just that dieting often isn't the solution for the majority of people who are struggling with their weight, and that even if you are overweight, you can be fit and healthy. But, you know, I think that's often something that I think is not said so much, with there being a lot of messages about you need to be a size, a very low size, in order to be healthy, and that's not necessarily the case. Of course, however, medical problems are associated with obesity and being overweight, which include hypertension, cardiovascular disease, and diabetes, etc. And then I think the final thing is that there's often a lot of discrimination against overweight people in our society, and that might lead to people feeling more depressed and anxious about their weight, but a lot of that's due to sort of cultural expectations, which are, you know, really discriminatory. Okay. Oh, right. And I promised that I'd talk briefly about EDNOS. So there's always one of these categories. So people who meet criteria for an eating disorder but not full criteria for anorexia nervosa or bulimia nervosa. As I said, this includes binge eating disorder. And it might be sort of the situations where, you know, someone meets all the criteria for anorexia but they have regular menses. Or their weight is in the normal range, actually, and not that low BMI range. So what I'm getting at with eating disorders not otherwise specified is that even if it is regarded as this sort of catch-all for everybody else who doesn't quite meet anorexia nervosa or bulimia nervosa criteria, it's quite an important catch-all because, first of all, a lot of clinics, about a third of people who come in have eating disorders not otherwise specified, and actually they might have problems that if you leave it for the next 6 months, it's going to really worsen, and a person might end up, say in the case of anorexia, being dangerously ill. Okay, so we pay a lot of attention, even if a person meets eating disorders not otherwise specified, because it just might be early in the course of the problem. And we know, say, certainly for anorexia nervosa, that the earlier you treat, the quicker you treat, probably the chances of overcoming it are better. Okay. Wow, I did finish. Okay, 7:43. Okay.
Well, that was just wonderful. That was wonderful. I just wonder if we could do maybe talk a little bit about treatment. Eunice, is there anything you wanted to say, or I could actually give you a question that came in from somebody about their daughter that maybe would be a good way to organize a question around eating, around treatment? Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so this is a 20-year-old daughter who has OCD, bipolar, some PTSD. She's obsessed with weighing herself, and even a half a pound is a struggle for her to accept. She's under 95 pounds at 5'2". Her therapist feels the scale and restrictive eating is her form of punishment. How can she overcome this and gain weight if the weighing is so constant? This person who writes in says, I feel until she stops weighing herself, we have no hope. What can be done? I feel anorexia is running the show. Her therapist feels it's a coping mechanism and it will resolve. Meanwhile, each time she gets on a scale and it's not compliant, she's a mess. At night after dinner, she spirals. Is this something, what kind of treatment might you consider? And is this, can this be done outpatient?
Can I check how old she is?
28.
28?
Yeah.
Okay. So, and then it sounds like she's got a body mass index of around 17.4. It sounds like, thank you for calling in today to listen, and it sounds like, you know, as a family, this is a very, very difficult problem to deal with, anorexia. It's often, you know, chronic, long-standing, and I think as parents, one can feel very helpless at times. And so my heart really goes out to you because I've worked with a lot of families and parents whose daughters or sons are struggling with this particular disorder. And in some ways it's even harder when your child grows older because they have more freedoms about making choices as to, you know, what sort of treatment and whether they get treatment. The first thing is that it is great that she's in treatment because I think that that definitely helps. I think that, you know, therapists are going to do different things. I think that, you know, if you're, I'll be really straight about what my sort of approach to treating a daughter would probably be. I think it would be obviously trying to understand more history, but I think that trying to get her weight up so that it's at a healthier weight would definitely be worth it. You know, we are doing some work with young adults now. These are folk aged between 18 and 25 who, so far, we've done a case series of 22 out of 30 clients. And what we're finding is, you know, we can not only have families involved where a client might go home and stay with their parents, or we could even, we've had situations where we've had folk get better where even their college friends have been the ones to help them eat. But I do think that, you know, an approach that involves, you know, people who are close to that individual being involved in their everyday eating, and that means pretty much every meal and every snack sometimes to start with, is kind of worth it. Why? Because I think that being at a low weight makes it very hard to deal with, it sounds like, all the other problems that she's struggling with. We know, you know, being a low weight for some people can increase being more obsessive, can increase the compulsions, increase people's anxiety. So definitely being able to get help for the other problems, I think, might be difficult if, you know, one can't get the weight back to a healthier weight. So in a sort of family-based or supportive-based treatment program, we would really ask either, you know, people who are close to that individual, and the individual's got to make the decision who that might be. It may not end up being family. It might be a boyfriend. It might be a husband or a spouse or partner, you know, but we really then engage with the partner to try to help them spend a lot of time with the person who's trying to increase their weight to do the meals. And the simple reason is because I think, you know, you just can't, it's very hard to do on your own because the alternative is thinking about day patient programs, so situations where you might have meals with staff, or even an inpatient program that might help you just aggressively regain weight so that you're at a healthier weight to be able to do all the things that you need to be doing. So that's possibly the route that I would probably consider or think about. And that's just given the amount of data out there. Like, you know, in my view, probably the family-based treatments are the strongest data for children and adolescents with anorexia nervosa. And it sort of makes sense that one might be able to take that and use that with particularly young adults or folk who are in some way, you know, still having connections with people who really care about them and will care about them for the rest of their lives.
And what is the family involvement or the family therapy that you're referring to?
So with children and adolescents, it does involve, you know, the parents really, you know, refeeding the child at home. It's an outpatient treatment. It's been done over 6 months. It's been done over 1 year, so various lengths of time. The therapist might work solely with the parents, with children and adolescents, or will work with the whole family together throughout the course of treatment. And really, I think from the very get-go, you know, therapists talk to families, especially with children and adolescents, about, you know, the seriousness of the disease, because anorexia is a very serious disease. You know, people can die, and you know, sometimes with, say, you know, if you have a child with cancer, you know, you would sort of, you know, you'd do everything, you know, to get your child better from cancer. You know, you'd go with them to chemo. You would stay with them at home despite, you know, having to go to work. You still try to manage that. And the thing about anorexia is that it's just as serious as something like cancer. And so, you know, we talk a lot in those sorts of situations with parents and children and adolescents with anorexia about, you know, the severity of the disease, and then also about, you know, how they can manage this in the home. And it's not an easy treatment, I'll be really straight, because mm-hmm. often parents will have to do things like, you know, sit through 3-hour dinners where an adolescent is having a tantrum and refuses to eat. But they know that the only way to perhaps get them through it is just to be there for that period of time and just keep on going back to, yeah, you can leave the table, but once you're done, you know, that sort of stuff. So it's not an easy treatment to do. And so you can also imagine if you try to do this with a young adult or an adult, you know, it crosses the boundaries of, you know, being an autonomous adult. It can be a very difficult thing to do again. So I think it's only if you're, you know, you've got that kind of relationship where you know you can do that and get through it despite the fact that your child or the person that you love is going to hate you for a lot of this treatment.
This is all outpatient treatment, and if it's an adult that's going to refuse, I mean, what else can you do?
Unfortunately, if that's the thing about when adults refuse to get treatment, this is where, you know, sadly enough, it might end up being things like, you know, you get them to see a medical doctor about something else, but the medical doctor knows that they really have anorexia and they need help. And I'll be utterly honest, there are cases where, you know, an adult is severely emaciated and ends up getting involuntarily, you know, put into hospital to refeed and to regain weight because mm-hmm.
Are there any of this overeating and anorexic behaviors, should it be viewed as fitting into the definition of self-harm?
You know, that's a very interesting question, Perry, because evidently one could definitely look at it from that perspective. And I think the key is it functions differently for different people. Mm-hmm. You know, for some people, if you look at how maybe they also self-injure, and actually the consequences and the antecedents are very similar for both the self-injury as possibly the anorexic behavior, then you might be like, okay, so this has a similar function to the self-injury that this person also engages in. But you might see other people for whom, you know, the weight loss behavior is not about, you know, like maybe emotion regulation purposes. Maybe mm-hmm. it's for other sorts of reasons as well. So it will vary from person to person.
Okay, and could you make a comment about how our culture might be seen as an invalidating environment that might promote, you know, symptoms of BPD?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so that's a very interesting question because, I mean, when I work with folk with borderline personality disorder and eating disorders, folk would also often say to me, and I think it definitely is an important component to think about, is that, you know, these messages about, you know, being thin, that being rewarded, that being seen as successful, they can be particularly powerful, you know, if you're emotionally vulnerable to them, okay? So I do think that can be an important contributing factor for some folk. Not everybody, but definitely for some folk.
Mm-hmm. And has research been conducted on the effect of bulimia or anorexic behaviors and endorphin levels?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think some people are looking at that, but, you know, sadly enough, with the eating disorders, some of the biological stuff in eating disorders, not enough work has been done on that mm-hmm. because I think that would definitely be a very interesting thing to look at more because a lot of people would describe, you know, losing weight has a kind of emotional high to it. Even the over-exercise that you might see in both of those disorders evidently has an emotional high to it as well that might make it a somewhat addictive behavior. But it's not, you know, the same as, you know, a standard, say, maybe addiction associated with alcohol and substances, but it might have that similar sort of it might work similarly in some ways for some people.
And do some people report experiencing emotional relief with deprivation and overconsumption?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question too. So some people, with deprivation, some people definitely describe like feeling emotionally better. And I think there's some evidence that suggests that they feel less anxious often. So there's that, which also means then in the course of treatment, as people get better from if they have anorexia, for instance, and maybe the anorexia was a way of managing extreme powerful emotions. So as people get better, sometimes those emotions might get more powerful over time, which can be, you know, a struggle to deal with. Can emotional relief come from also overeating? Yes, definitely. Yeah. So I think people with bulimia nervosa and binging disorder, and people who binge in the context of anorexia, will often report how that behavior might be, you know, as a way of feeling better, or even kind of escaping sometimes from emotions as well.
Mm-hmm. I think my daughter is a binge eater. She was diagnosed with major depression and BPD. How can DBT be incorporated to include the binge eating issues?
I think it can be incorporated by treating it as one of the behaviors. I mean, if she's interested in changing this behavior, and she's seeing someone who's doing DBT, I would strongly suggest that she talk to them about how this is an important goal for her to try to change it, because what they could do is treat it as one of the behaviors you work on changing in the target hierarchy. And so that might end up being what we call quality of life interfering behavior, which comes under life-threatening and therapy interfering behaviors. So that could become something that, you know, gets discussed each week individually in treatment. If you're in group skills, it might be that you can also use some of the skills you're learning to deal with the binge eating. So I think that can definitely be dealt with in the context of standard DBT.
And has DBT been modified at all for eating disorders?
Oh, yes. So there's a number of interesting adaptations and developments. So Stanford, there's a group out at Stanford with Deborah Safer, Christy Telch, who have taken dialectical behavior therapy skills and then just using the skills given these to folk with binging disorder or bulimia nervosa, and they've had very strong results for both of those problems. They only deliver the skills, so there's not the individual component of psychotherapy, and their treatment is about 20 sessions long. There's that. Marsha and I published a small case series, if you're interested, on folk who had bulimia nervosa or binging disorder and also borderline personality disorder, where we really just minimally adapted standard dialectical behavior therapy. Lucine Wiskensi, who is in Cleveland, Ohio, works a lot with people across the range with eating disorders. She also has like a day patient and I think is connected to an inpatient program. So they're developing a model of DBT for those settings as well. And Tom Lynch in the UK, he and I are starting some work together to try to take the DBT skills but also add skills for people who have over-controlled emotions, because we know in the case of anorexia that it's not about often loss of control, it's about almost having too much control over emotions. And so there's a lot of exciting work, I think, happening out there with DBT and for folk with anorexia and also bulimia and binging disorder.
Mm-hmm. And then is it generally more effective to treat co-occurring and coexisting disorders prior to treating the eating disorder, or is concurrent therapy generally recommended?
I wish that I had a more straightforward answer to that. And in some ways, you know, this is subject to more testing. I feel like, you know, we often ask these questions, and unfortunately researchers are not meeting those questions with answers. Okay, so what I can give you is some of my clinical impressions, but also, you know, things that are more based on, you know, studies that are, they're not the perfect studies to kind of address this question, so if that makes any sense. So it sort of will depend somewhat it seems like, on the disorder. So I think, say, working with Marsha's group, I think that things like bulimia nervosa, binge eating disorder, and anorexia can be addressed in the context of, say, borderline personality disorder. But I think that one has to carefully think through, say, where do these eating disorder behaviors sit on the hierarchy? So I think that means that you really need, it's very important if you're choosing a clinician to find someone who's not only experienced in DBT but also experienced in working with eating disorders. Okay, and then there are, I mean, there's, of course, Cobb Behaviour Therapy Enhanced. So this is Chris Fairbairn, the guy from England who developed CBT for bulimia. So that has, you know, just been developed, like, I think his book came out in 2009, and it does take people with the range of eating disorders. The data on bulimia nervosa and eating disorders not otherwise specified seems to be pretty good, but it seems to be fairly similar to previous studies with his more more diagnostic-specific manual. So I think in that model, in the CBT model, I think Chris Fairbairn would regard that one could treat these various eating disorders, but in the context also of co-occurring disorders, possibly with the exception of being, you know, recurrently suicidal, because a lot of those studies that have been done with CBT for, say, bulimia have ruled out people who are suicidal at the time.
Eunice, this has just been absolutely wonderful. I think there are going to be more questions coming in. I would like to end on a very positive note that someone sent a nice email to say that they had had an eating disorder for 25 years, and really what led them out of that was finding a passion of something that they wanted to do. They now are a writer writing about things other than their eating disorder per se, but that this person recommends finding something where you really get so distracted and throw yourself into something else in life, and to her that made all the difference. So it's nice to end on a positive note that there is recovery and people do get better and move on from it.
Yeah.
Is there anything you'd like to end with?
No, absolutely. But that's a wonderful story, and thank you for sharing that with us, to know that, you know, getting a life worth living is a thing that displaces an eating disorder. That's terrific to hear.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much, and your time and your commitment and your willingness to join us tonight, and we hope we can get you back for something else.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Perry.
Thank you. Take
care.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye.